Good morning. I learned a valuable lesson. This clicker works from the back of the room, so I can walk all over the place. All right, well, thanks has been given, and waistbands have been expanded. Buckeyes lost, but oh well, even blind rat finds cheese once in a while. All right, we're going to be in 1 Corinthians 13. You may want to turn there. We're going to continue our series that we've been doing in 1 Corinthians. So, you may want to turn there. I'm going to go ahead and pray before we get started. Lord, thank you for this passage. It's a passage on love, something that I'm not all that good at, but you've worked on me over the years, and I'm sure I'm not the only one that struggled with loving others. So I pray, God, that you use this opportunity to teach us something about what you have to say about love and how important it is in our lives. Amen. All right, I've said a couple of times before that I like 1 and 2 Corinthians because the Corinthian church was so much like our church. Their culture was so much like our culture. You know, it's funny how we like, you know, people in our culture, we like to think of anybody that was around before the cotton gin as like cavemen or something, and that we have nothing in common with them. And the truth of the matter is, man, people have not changed. Technology has changed. The way we interact with each other has changed. Hygiene has gotten better, but you know our hearts haven't changed all that much over the centuries. And this is a church; it's in a city, it's an urban church, much like ours. They had a lot of gifts, you know, spiritual gifts. The first chapter of 1 Corinthians, he praises them, and they have so many spiritual gifts in their church. They had a lot of people that were committed to the Lord there, and yet they had their specific set of problems. And Paul then wrote this letter to them to address the problems, and we have a lot of the same issues in our church. So I think this is such a great letter for us because of that. And this passage in particular in 1 Corinthians 13 is probably one of the most famous passages in the Bible. I'm sure if you've gone to a wedding any time in the last 200 years that you've heard it, or at least part of it. And yet, it has a lot to say about love, and it's very poetic and very neat, and yet we can learn a lot more of it once we put it in the context of the rest of the book. Because Paul, believe it or not, did not write this passage about weddings, or even for weddings. Weddings were even mentioned in it. We kind of lift it out of context and put it in the weddings, and that's fine, but I think we can learn a lot more from it once we put it in the context of the rest of the letter. So let's go ahead and jump into it. The first verse there, he says, if I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but I do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and I know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, well, then I'm nothing. And if I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I surrender my body to be burned, but I don't have love, it profits me nothing. So here Paul is saying something is important here. What is important? Love, right? Duh. It's pretty obvious. Love is important here. And it's, in fact, it's more important than a lot of other things that the Corinthians at the time thought was important. You know, the Corinthians, we start with this one, speaking with tongues. This is a spiritual gift that was given to certain people, not everybody, but was given to specific people in the Bible. And It was kind of a symbol of God speaking through about angels or through angels or through the tongues of men, the languages of men that they didn't necessarily know ahead of time. And, you know, the church had elevated this gift that they have and to a point where they were arguing about how prominent it should be in their services when they got together. In fact, there's a whole chapter, the next chapter of 1 Corinthians talks a lot about tongues. And so what they'd done is they'd lifted this one up, and they were real proud of the people who could speak in tongues were real proud of it, you know, and they thought it should be a very prominent thing. They thought it was a sign of honor, and they wanted it to be elevated above other people because they could do it. And Paul is saying, you know what, if you're speaking in tongues, you know, but you don't have love, you're just a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And you might wonder at first, you know, what's wrong with noisy gongs and clanging cymbals, right? Cymbals are loud, they're instruments. David used them when he would have music in his temple. You know, what's the, or not his temple, his synagogue, or his church, I forget what the tabernacle, goodness gracious. Monty took my notes away this morning. I can't remember. Anyway, David used them when he would worship. And yet, here he's talking about them like they're a bad thing. And what he's talking about here is the pagan temples at the time in Corinth. They would have these parades to get attention to their gods, and they would go around with gongs and cymbals and make a lot of noise so people would pay attention to them. And here is Paul, he's saying, look, if you're speaking with tongues, if you're here trying to speak in tongues and you're trying to elevate that up above everything else, then you're just like they are. You're just doing it to bring attention to yourself. That's the only reason to do it, because you're doing it without love. And we're not here to bring attention to ourselves. We're here to bring attention to God. So he says, it's worthless. Then he goes on, because remember I said that the church here had been given a lot of spiritual gifts. And in fact, the last chapter that Dave taught last week in chapter 12, he mentioned a lot of the spiritual gifts that they had. And he says, you know, the gift of prophecy, if you have the gift of prophecy, and you know all mysteries, and have all knowledge, and all faith to remove mountains, he says, if you don't have love, then you're nothing. And these are specific gifts that he mentions that I want to point out. The gift of prophecy is not just seeing into the future. That's only a minor part of the gift of prophecy. Gift of prophecy is really speaking as God's mouthpiece, delivering messages from God to the culture. Usually it's counterculture. It's against the culture. And the reason that it is associated with seeing into the future is because in order to prove that you could do that, that you're speaking for God, you had to be able to predict the future reliably, because only God can do that. So he says, if you are a teacher and you know all mysteries, you know, have all knowledge, and the mysteries that Paul's talking about are the mysteries of Christ, the mystery that God had a plan all along to redeem human beings through his Son, and you have this knowledge, all of it, and you have a full understanding of Scriptures, and you have faith to remove mountains. And this isn't just faith in Christ to save yourself or be saved, but it's the faith, a visionary faith to lead people, faith to lead a movement. He's talking about these are the gifts, in other words, that are associated with leadership and teaching in the church. He says, if you have these gifts and you're not using them out of love, then you're nothing. You're nothing. Even with these wonderful gifts. And he says, if I give all of my possessions to feed the poor and I surrender my body to be burned, it profits me nothing without love. Now that says something there. So he's gone over the gifts that they have. And now there's this other group of people in the church that he's talking to, the group of people that were very moral. Because there were some of those. There were people that were immoral in the church, certainly. But there were people in the church that they looked at themselves as being very moral. And he says, look, even if you have given away all your possessions, not just given out of your excess, but given everything, living a life of poverty so that others can have money. That's kind of a liberal view of mortality, where we give everything for others, right? And that's how we should be. And that's kind of what the Occupy people are saying, right? That's a very liberal view, that the others should give. Those who are rich should give everything they have. There's nothing wrong with that if you want to do that. But he also says, if I surrender my body to be burned, if I die in the defense of my faith, he's talking about martyrdom here. That's a very conservative view. That's a conservative moral value, isn't it? To defend your faith to the death. Even if I do that, but I don't have love, it profits me nothing. He's covering the whole spectrum. He's covering all their gifts. He's covering all their morality. And he says, if you're doing it all without love, it's nothing. And in fact, I think I like this word that he uses at the end of chapter 3, it profits me nothing. I think that's telling. You know, you'll see a lot of, you know, when you're thinking about profiting, you know, you don't think about being moral for profit. But if you're doing it without love, then there's no other reason for it. You know, they thought that they could earn God's favor, or they could earn respect through their morality. And what had happened is you've got a church here that followed Christ, believed in Christ, but their hearts hadn't changed. Love hadn't changed their hearts. and they were not loving others. They were very moral. They were very gifted. They were very talented and intelligent. They had a lot going for them, but they didn't have love, and it was so important that Paul says they've got nothing. And I think it goes beyond that. You know, I've had struggled with love over the years. I've always tried to live on the straight and narrow path. You know, I'm not saying I was perfect. There's too many people in here who've known me for a long time. Dad's here even, so he can tell you. But I've always tried to be moral, and I've always tried to be right, you know, and I do the right thing. And even though I was surrounded by people a lot of the times that were doing the wrong thing, I tried not to get involved in that. But it wasn't out of love. And over the years, I developed this empty feeling within me. You know, have you ever felt that way? Like you know, you're following God, you're doing the right things, the things that you're supposed to do, and yet you're empty. You know, there's nothing in your heart. There's nothing. And that's what I would feel. And I remember one time I was walking from work, and I was walking out of the parking lot or towards my car, and I had my hand on the handle of the car door, and I was just praying, God, I don't have love. I don't know how to love people. You know, I had a wife, I was married, and I knew I felt love for her, but I didn't have love. You know, I didn't know how to express it. And anybody else, man, the world, people, I did not like people. I was in the same situation. I had gifts. I was trying to be moral. But it wasn't out of love. For me, it was more out of guilt and fear of punishment. So again, it's profit, right? I'm trying to stay comfortable. I'm trying to stay in my comfort zones. But I didn't have love. So what's the deal here? How is this possible? Well, Paul's going to go on and he's going to tell us how it's possible. And we get to this. This is the most popular part of the chapter. This is the part I mentioned. It's brought up in weddings a lot. And you see it on stickers and magnets and refrigerator doors. Sometimes we'll bring it up in arguments with our spouses even. Love is patient. How many times are we going to tell you that? Love is kind, dummy. You know, we bring these things up and we have no idea what we're saying because we've taken it out of context. Let's read this. Love is patient. Love is kind. It's not jealous. Love does not brag. It's not arrogant. It does not act unbecomingly. It does not seek its own. It's not provoked. It doesn't take into account a wrong suffered. It does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. It goes on, and we're going to circle back and read the rest of those, but I want to point out these particular ones. Paul's not just going and saying, all right, if I was going to define love, how would I define it? He's giving these as examples. These are all issues that he's brought up throughout the rest of this letter. Issues with this church. Were they patient? Was this church patient? If you've been here over the last few weeks, you'd know. Is this church patient? No. They're not patient with each other. Not at all. They're impatient people. They're not kind to each other. Are you kidding? These people were arguing with each other about which teacher was better. And they were vilifying the other group, saying that they weren't even real Christians because they followed Paul and not Apollos. They don't brag. Does not brag and is not arrogant. These people bragged. They were arrogant. And I think it's not despite they had gifts, it's because they had the gifts that made them arrogant. They thought they were their own. People who were moral were immoral in such a way that they were self-righteous. They were arrogant. They acted unbecomingly. They were constantly seeking their own. They were taking each other to court on a regular basis. They were suing each other. That's the very definition of taking into account a wrong suffered. In short, they were rejoicing in unrighteousness and not in the truth. This is not a definition of love as much as it is a condemnation for these people. Paul had just got done telling them how awful, you know, you've got problems here, here, and here. And now he's mentioning, again, these problems and saying, you don't have love. That's the issue. Because love doesn't act this way. You can have so much going for you, but if you don't have love, it's nothing. You see, I don't have how to explain it any better. These people, they were lost. You know, they wanted to love God, but they weren't. And in because of that, their hearts were empty. They couldn't love other people. And here they are in this situation. And Paul has a fix for that, though. But I want, before I get to that, I want to talk about here everything that they were doing for their own profit. And there's Charles Spurgeon had this great quote that he used, and I'm not going to quote him directly because I don't remember it word for word, but it was this little story that he told. It was about this guy who lived in a canyon. He was a gardener, right? And this gardener grew a carrot, and it was a big, big carrot, right? It was a beautiful carrot. And he decides, you know what, I'm going to go to the king. So he goes to the king, and he says to the king, you know what, I'm just a gardener. I don't do great things, but you know what, this is the best carrot. This is the best thing I'm ever going to grow. It's the best thing I ever have grown. I'll never do anything better, and I want you to have it. I want you to have it because I love you, because you're the king, and I respect you, and I love you, and I think that you should have the best of what I have. And he turns around, and he leaves. And before he gets out the door, the king says, you know what, stop. Clearly, you're somebody I can trust. He says, I own all the land that's next to your garden. I want you to have it. I'm going to give that to you because clearly you're somebody who loves what he does, and you love me, and I want you to have it out of the kindness of my heart. So, of course, the guy's happy, and he leaves. Well, there was a rich lord in there in the court at the time, and he saw what happened here, and he starts thinking, well, if I can get all of that, or if you could get all of that for a carrot, I wonder what I can get, right? And so he starts thinking. And the next day, he comes into the court, and he leads this giant, this beautiful horse, right? And he says, as you know, king, you know, I breed horses, and this is the best horse I've ever bred. I'll never breed a better horse. I want you to have it. And, of course, the king, he sees through this pretty quickly. He's smart. He says, look, that guy yesterday, the gardener, he gave me the carrot. But you're giving yourself the horse. You see what he's saying here? You're giving yourself the horse. That's what they were doing. Everything that they did, all their morality, all of their gifts, all of their service, everything that they did was for themselves. They were giving themselves the horse. And Paul then goes through this definition of love, and he says, look, your morality doesn't mean anything. Your gifting doesn't mean anything because you're doing it without love. If you want to judge how you're growing as a Christian, how you're growing as a child of God, throw the Ten Commandments out the window. We like to use the Ten Commandments. We like to say, look, I haven't murdered. All right, one for me. I haven't lied today. You know, and we go through this list, and we think we're doing good. But we're doing that without love. And I'm not saying the Ten Commandments are bad. What I am saying is that that's not the true measure of faith. That's not a true measure of a heart that's been changed by God. This is. See how you stack up against this list. And then you'll see how well you're growing. You know, are you patient? Are you kind? Are you jealous? This is the list. This is the how you stack up. It's about love. It's not about your fake morality. Paul goes on. We're going to skip down to chapter 8, or to verse 8 here. Because he's going to talk about the most crucial point. This is, you don't have love. All right, this is what you need to get your hands on. This is the piece of the passage that we don't hear in scriptures, or we don't hear in weddings, I mean. But this is the part of the passage that Paul says, you don't have love, this is how you're going to get it. This is where the rubber meets the road. And it's kind of difficult to understand. Albert Einstein once said that if you can't explain something simply, then you probably don't understand it well enough. We'll see if I understand this well enough. All right, because I don't. Love is difficult. It's difficult for everybody, but I've had my issues with it, as I said. And this part here, this is something he has to say about love that I don't think that they got, and I think sometimes we forget it too. He says, if there are gifts of prophecy, they'll be done away, and if there are tongues, they will cease, and if there is knowledge, it will be done away. So he goes back to their gifts. He says they're all going away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will be done away. When I was a child, I used to speak like a child, think like a child, reason like a child. And when I became a man, I did away with childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I will know fully, just as I also have been fully known. All right, so this is what he has to say about love. And at first glance, it's hard to understand. So let's break it down a little bit. First of all, he says, If you want to know about love, he says, right now, things are hard. You know, we know in part that he uses a word that actually it's a root of the word conundrum. It's hard. We don't understand things very well, right? But we will know in the future. If something is coming that will change us. It's this word perfect. He says the perfect comes. And the Greek word here is teleos. And it's a difficult word to get your hands around because it's not a word that has a single English translation. You know, there's no word in English that translates directly as teleos. They try perfect. There's other translations in the Bible. It's used other times in the Bible, and they've used different things, mature sometimes. But it's never, it's not a one-word translation. The best I can come up with is the example of the butterfly. Butterflies, when they're pupa, they're these worms, right? We all know this. They're these worms, and they kind of crawl around, and they're ugly, and they're fat and juicy when you step on them. I mean, they're gross little things, and, you know, they don't move around very well. You know, if they want to get from one stick to another, they got to crawl all the way down and over and all the way back up, and it takes them all day just to get anywhere. They don't move around very well. They're not beautiful. But something happens in their life cycle. And when that happens, they become butterflies. They become, where they were clumsy, they become graceful. Where they were ugly, they become beautiful. Where they were unable to move around, now they're free. They've matured. They've become what they were designed to be. They've hit teleos. Teleos has come. That's what that means. They've entered into their element. They've matured into something that they were designed to be. And so Paul is saying, when that comes for us, all this other stuff will be done away with. It won't be confusing anymore. It won't be difficult anymore. We'll be fully matured. We'll have realized our potential. We'll be the creatures that God has designed us to be. Right now, we're those little worms. But in the future, we're going to be those butterflies. There's something beautiful within us that God is growing within us. And it's our focus on that. It's the extent that we focus on that and focus on God, on that, this perfect thing that's coming, that we can grow. And when we get to that teleos, that's how we grow in love. He says, and he goes on with this maturity theme. He says, when I was a child, you know, I used to speak like a child and think like a child and reason like a child. Of course, I was childish. How does a child think? Children are selfish, aren't they? You ever have to teach your kid how to lie? No, we spend all of our time teaching our kids not to lie. You ever teach your kid how to be selfish? How to withhold stuff from other people? No, that's the default operating system that's installed in us at birth, right? I mean, we understand this. We spend all of the rest of our lives giving software patches to our kids so they learn how to not be this way. Kids are childish. Childishness is bad. Our culture likes to say, you know, the mouth of the child, and there's always truth in what they say. That's not, These kids, we people don't have kids, apparently, because kids lie a lot. And they get better at it. Okay, he says, when I was a child, I used to think like a child. I had no category for delayed gratification. And Paul here is, he was a moral guy. We've talked about him before and how he was the top. He was in the Sanhedrin. He was a Pharisee. If you wanted to say, all right, who would be an example of someone who's moral, you would point at Paul, because this guy never broke the rules. He was zealous about following the rules. And yet he's saying, I was a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. I reasoned that God, the way I could get to God was through my work, through following his rules. And he says, that was a mistake. Because when I became a man, I did away with childish things. Does that mean that he gave up on his morality? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. What it did mean was that his morality had a new meaning. Had a new definition, had a new drive behind it, because he learned about love. He says, now we see in a mirror dimly. We don't really see the future. We don't know what our teleos is going to be. We don't know what our butterfly is going to look like. We don't see, we have an idea, but it's like looking in a dirty mirror. We see it dimly. He says, but then we'll see it face to face. So this thing that is coming, this teleos, this perfection, has a face. It's not some faceless power. It's not some future date. It's not some evolutionary thing that we're working towards. It is a personal being that has a face. You see what he's saying here? This isn't something that we work towards and hopefully by the end of our lives we get there. No, he's saying, if you want to grow in love, you've got to meet love. You've got to meet the person who is love. He has a face. He says, now I know in part, but then I will know fully, just as I have been fully known. And this is an interesting thing here. He says, you know, at first glance you want to think, he's saying, in the future I will know him and he will know me. But that's not what it says, is it? He says, in the future, I will know him just as I have been fully known. This, in fact, the verb tense is weird. It's a past tense in our translation, but the tense in the Greek, it's this aortic tense, and we don't even have the same thing in our language. It's referring to a point in time, an event that happened at one time. And he says, I was fully known at that time, and I was loved. You might say, well, God, yeah, of course God knows this, right? He knows everybody. He's God. And you're right, to a certain extent. But if that's the argument you're making, you don't understand what it means in the Bible to know somebody. In both the Hebrew, in the Old Testament, in the Greek, and the New Testament, the word know has some heavier meaning than what we use today. You know, when Adam knew Eve and they conceived a child, right? It's not because he asked her a few questions about herself. Right, we understand that, right? I hope we understand that's not what he's talking about. He says when they know each other, they had an intimate relationship. And at one point in time, Paul is saying, he knew me. At one point, there was a point in time when he didn't, and there was a point in time that he did. Something happened, and he knew me. Why is that so important? This is crucial. Because this isn't some get-to-know-God kind of thing. This is why is knowing somebody and loving somebody, why are they so crucially put together? Well, you think about it. If somebody who you just met comes and says, man, I love you, that's nice to hear, but does it really mean anything? You'd think, well, you don't really know me, so you don't love me at all. If you did, you wouldn't, right? Or what's worse? What's worse than that is somebody who really knows you very well, who has had an intimate relationship with you, and yet rejects you. That's even worse. Because now you've been fully known and not loved. But Paul here is saying, the King of the universe fully knows us and fully loves us. What is that like? You know, that's something on a level beyond what we can understand, isn't it? I mean, I've been married for 17 years, and I can't tell you everything about Dawn. And she can't tell you everything about me. We've known each other for a long time. We've been in an intimate relationship with each other. And we love each other, but there's still some stuff, I'm sure, that we haven't uncovered. I mean, there's no way we can tell each other everything. But here, God, who built us from the ground up, says that you're fully loved and you're fully known. And that's how we change. There's something about meeting him face to face. And it's a decision that we have to make. You know, Jesus said once that in the end, there will be people come to me and they will say, Jesus, we did all these things in your name. We did all these great works in your name. And I will tell them that I never knew you. Does that mean that he didn't recognize their faces? No, he's God. He knows them. He knows who they are. But he never knew them. He never had that relationship with them. And it wasn't his fault. It's because they decided to try to earn his favor, to try to get something from him. as opposed to just loving him for who he is. You see the difference there? Paul's telling us, if you want to grow in love, if you want to have love in your heart and you want to have love for other people, then you have to meet love. You have to have this face-to-face event with love. That's important. And so I want to circle back to that passage. I'm going to look at the rest of it, this definition of love. Because he does something neat here that I think sometimes we miss because we write it off as kind of poetic language. But he anthropomorphizes love here. He personalizes it. He gives it, instead of saying, I think if you're going to be loving, that means you need to be more patient and you need to be kind. That's not what he's saying here. He's making love a person. He's saying love is patient. That's why this is so personal. God is patient, he's saying. He's got somebody in mind when he's writing this. It's not just something out there for us to work towards. He's saying this is a person. Love is a person. You got to know who he had in mind when he wrote this. This word patient, it actually is translated long-suffering. Who was more long-suffering than Christ when he allowed himself to be crucified? To be put to death in the most horrible way human beings had ever come up with to date. He was long-suffering. Who was kinder than Christ when they were putting him up there on that cross, that he looked to the person who had just been mocking him earlier and said, today you'll be with me in paradise. That's kind. He wasn't jealous. He didn't brag. He wasn't arrogant. He had the chance. He was up in front of the Pontius Pilate. He could have bragged about himself. He was in front of the king, and he could have bragged about himself there, and he chose not to. He remained silent. He didn't act unbecomingly. He didn't seek his own. He came from heaven. He came from a place that we can't even imagine how good it was, and he came here for us. If he was seeking his own, he would never have done that. He certainly didn't take into account any wrong suffered. He wasn't provoked, was he? In fact, it was because he allowed himself to be nailed to the cross and be crucified. It wasn't for his wrongs, it was for ours. It was because we had so many wrongs against him that he died so that we could be forgiven. He certainly didn't rejoice in unrighteousness, but he rejoiced in the truth. Do you see here what Paul is saying here? Love is a person. Love is Jesus. And he did all of these things that they were not doing. You want to love, you want to grow in love, and you want to have something. You want to get rid of that empty feeling that we talked about. No matter how much you try, you get this empty feeling. You want to get rid of that. It's because you need to focus on Christ. And up until this point, the first, verses 4, 5, and 6, we can look at those verses and we can say, all right, well, love is patient. That's difficult, but I understand that. We agree with that. You know, it's kind, it's not jealous. These are things that we can look at and we can kind of nod along with. Yeah, love is these things. All right. But then he goes beyond that, doesn't he? Look at the next verses. Love does not, he says, love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. Now we've gone overboard. All right, Paul, he went too far. What does that mean? Anyway, how can anybody love like that? That's not only impossible, it's not even desirable, right? We don't want to be like that. Well, first of all, let's see what he's talking about. My translation, the New American Standard Bible, puts this word things in there, and that's not actually in the translation. It actually says it bears all, it believes all, it hopes all, it endures all. Or maybe always endures, always believes, always hopes. Okay. So here we are, and we're looking at this, and we're thinking, well, somebody who does this is gullible, and he's a doormat, right? Is that what we're supposed to be? Are we supposed to be gullible doormats that let people walk all over us? Well, we're supposed to be. Remember, the focus here is not on us. Focus is on other people. And here we are. We're always thinking about ourselves. Well, I got to do this. I got to put up with that. Are you kidding? Let's take a better look at it. It bears all. Jesus bore a lot. He bore all of our sins when he was on the cross so that we wouldn't have to bear the punishment for them. Believes all. Did Jesus believe everybody and everything? Well, no. No, he didn't. Jesus knew that people were rotten. It said early in John chapter 2, he says, Jesus, for his part, he wasn't entrusting himself to those, for he knew all men. And because he did not need anyone to testify concerning man, he himself knew what was in man. He knew men. He knows people. He knows our hearts. Someone who's gullible gets let down and says, oh my gosh, how did that happen? But they weren't loving. It wasn't about love. They weren't trusting out of love. They were trusting out of gullibility. When you trust out of love, you trust and you hope in this person, knowing that not only is it possible for them to let you down, but it's likely that they're going to let you down. You see the difference? Jesus, even though he knew the hearts of men, even though he knew that people were evil and rotten, he died for us anyway. It wasn't because he was gullible. It was because he loved us. When you love somebody, you go into a relationship knowing that they're likely going to let you down, and that's okay because you love them. And does that mean that you have to endure all? You know, does that mean that you have to take everything that they give you? No. If they're sinning against you, then you should talk to them. Why? That's not because they're sinning against you. It's because when they're sinning, they're hurting themselves. And you love them, and you don't want to see them hurting themselves. So sometimes you have to tell people that you're sinning. And you have to actually tell them that you may have to be harsh with them because they're hurting themselves. And when you approach it that way, out of love, out of concern for the other person rather than concern for yourself, that conversation takes on a whole new meaning, doesn't it? The anger is out of it. Now you're approaching them and saying, look, you know, what you're doing is wrong, and it hurts you. You're damaging yourself. You're damaging your relationship with God. You can't let that continue. But it's because you love the person, not because you're getting your feelings hurt. And talk about enduring all. You know, endurance, this is something that Jesus had. What was his last word on the cross? It is finished. Tetelestai, it was the Greek word. That's a word, if you've been around for a while here at Xenos, you know that word it's a legal term that they put at the bottom of a contract once it's been fulfilled, or a debt paper, you know. It is finished, paid in full. He would not allow himself to die until his work was finished. That's endurance. So Paul here is saying, look, you want to grow in love. It's not a matter of trying harder. It's not a matter of trying to muster up feelings for people that you just don't have. You notice he did not say love is a feeling ever. He says you want to grow in love, then you got to meet the person who loves you and fully knows you, and that's Christ. You meet him, and it begins by just coming to God and saying, God, I know that I'm a sinner. I know that I don't know how to love other people. And I want Christ's death to pay for my sins. Because my sins earn me a death sentence. I know it. I can't earn my way to you. I can't work my way to you. The only way I can get to you is through Christ's death paying for my sins. I want that to pay for me. That's how you begin that relationship. That's that event that Paul was referring to. He was fully known and fully loved. You go to God with that, and he'll honor that, and he'll help grow you in love if you cooperate with him. But sometimes we come off the rails, and we don't cooperate with him, and we may have been Christians for years even, and yet we got that empty feeling because we've not been loving others. So what do we do? How do we overcome that? How do we grow in love? I want to spend the next few minutes talking about that. First off, Paul is saying, you need to dwell on the person who love is. not dwell on what love is. We're not talking about dwelling on the definition of love. We're talking about dwelling on who love is, the person who love really is. What has Christ done for you? Dwell on that. He died for your sins. He allowed you to have a relationship with God, even though you deserve to have judgment from Him. And it was at a great cost to Himself, even though it's free to us. That is humongous. That's enormous. And as you grow as a Christian, you'll realize just how much was forgiven. You start to see in your life just how sinful you really are. And you realize, I've already been forgiven for this? You've got to be kidding me. That is amazing. And you look at the way He's changed you. You know, I can look back from that day when I was holding on to my car door, praying, to today. God has done some things with me. He's changed me. Now, I'm not perfect, and I don't love people nearly as well as I should. But I'll tell you something. He's taken away that emptiness that was in me. And He's worked on me, and He's changed me. And He'll do the same for you. And I can look back at that, and I can see, that's where I was, this is where I am. Man, God has done some amazing things in me. I cannot forget that. I can't let myself think that I did this on my own. I need to dwell on that. And then I need to think about what Christ will do when that perfect comes, when teleos happens. How great will that be when we are finally in our element, when God has finally allowed us to reach the potential He's put within us? How awesome will that be? That will be wonderful. And we need to focus on others. You know, our focus is always on ourselves, all the time. And we need to start getting out of ourselves, because that's not what love is. Love is not about us. Love is about others. It's about doing for others through prayer. That's a great way to love others. If, you know, the very least you can do for somebody is pray for them sometimes. You know, and that's, sometimes that's also the most you can do. Sometimes that's the best thing you can do. Praying for people. You got a problem with somebody, the best advice I've ever had when I've had problems with somebody who I know, pray for that person. And I'm not just saying general, God, please take this person out of my life. I'm not just saying, God, please make this person easier for me to get along with. I mean, get to know this person. God, I know this person's bitter and angry, but he has issues with his kids. But I pray that those issues with his kids get resolved, you know. Get to know him, find out things about him, and pray about him, real things. It's hard to dislike somebody when you're praying for them. You know, you want to get to know them. You want to find out if those prayers are working. Serve them. Find out what their needs are and try to help meet them. Service for people that you love, that you like, that you get along with is easy. Service for people that you don't like, that's really, really hard. You've got to get in there with them and serve them. That'll take your mind off yourself and off your own problems, and it'll put them on somebody else. And use your gifts. When in the last chapter, chapter 12, Paul talked about spiritual gifts. And what were they there for? They were there. Each one has been given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. Not for their own good, not for their own edification, but for the edification of others, growing the church. Use the gifts that God has given you to help others. That's the only reason to use them. Otherwise, you're a clanging cymbal. You're nothing. You're worthless. Finally, you know, I said love is not a feeling, and it's not, but it doesn't mean that love is incompatible with feelings. You know, we tend to think sometimes in our church we get a little overly intellectual. And we look at a list like this and we say, oh, we're not a legalistic church, so I've got this list of love, the things that I'm supposed to do is love, and I'm going to follow this list instead, which is just as legalistic as if I was to say, I'm going to follow all the rules in the Old Testament. I'm not going to miss any of them. You know, love is not incompatible with feelings. In fact, the more you love people, the more you serve them and then pray about them and get involved in their lives, those feelings grow, and you start to care about them. And you start to have those feelings. And you know what? These feelings aren't fleeting. They're not as fragile as what we think of as love in our culture. This love where it's more of an affection or a not infection, I said affection. Though it acts like an infection, it kind of overwhelms us, right? And we get hot flashes and stuff, and then it goes away. You know, that's not what love is. We're talking about a long, enduring love for people. And you can grow that. That affection, that warm-heartedness, that kindness in our hearts for people that I never had earlier, but that God has been growing within me. You get that as you love others. It's not incompatible with feelings, not at all. So I want to close with the last verse in chapter 13. I have 9 through 13, but it's just 13. He says, faith, hope, and love abide in these three, but the greatest of these is love. And all of them are necessary, right? Faith means taking action based on what you know to be true. You know, even though it is difficult, I know Christ died for me, so my faith in him is what saves me. It's taking action based on what we know to be true. Hope in the Bible means it's not like I hope I win the lottery. It's more it's a certainty. You know what's coming, and you have hope in that. It gives you hope. I know that teleos is coming, and I have hope in that, and that's what drives me. It's what motivates me. Those are important, but love, he says, is the greatest. Why is that? Have you ever considered that? Why? I mean, if all of them are necessary, why is love so much more important than the others? Well, he kind of answered that question already for us, didn't he, in our passage? He says, you know, in the future, when the perfect comes, when that teleos happens, and we get to be with God face to face, are we going to need faith? Faith is the hope in things unseen. We'll have seen it. God will be there face to face. We don't need faith anymore because we'll have seen it. We'll be there with him. Hope is the assurance of things to come. It already came in the future. It'll already have been there. We'll already have it. We don't need hope anymore because we'll be living in the future that we're looking forward to. But love. Love's all we'll have left in the future. You see why love is so much more important? Of all the things that you can do now to prepare for eternity, growing in love is the only one that will have any lasting value because it's the only thing we'll have left. If you want to prepare for eternity, you want to prepare for being with God for the next few million years, and then some, grow in love. Yeah, you need to grow in faith, of course. Yes, you need to grow in hope, of course. But the greatest of these is love, because that's all we'll have left. That's all we're going to need. And the more you grow in love, the better prepared you will be to live in eternity. How great will that be when that's all we have left? All right, we're done for today. We're going to have a time for questions and comments. So if you have questions and comments, start thinking about those now. We'll give you a chance to ask. If you're a first-time guest, welcome. I'm glad you're here. We have a gift to give you if you'd like. We have a couple of books. You're welcome to one of them. If you're a couple, then you can each have one, and you'll have both. But you can get those at the welcome table over there. Those are free. They're both good books. You know, if you're here investigating Christianity and you think, is it kind of goofy? Is it one of those just weird cult religions or something? The first book is great because it kind of gives solid evidence for Christianity. If you're here thinking that, you know, you can work your way to God, that you can be good enough to get to God, the other one is a really good book because it's how good is good enough. That's something good to know. That's something the lawyers and my daughter are really good at asking. How good do I have to be? What are the rules? For anybody, guests or not, if you have a question that you don't know, you don't want to ask in front of everybody, or you have a comment that you want to give us, feel free to fill out that welcome card. We'll get back to you. Or if you just want to do it anonymously, that's fine too. You don't have to put your name on it, but just drop it in the bag as it comes around. That bag is for us, though. For the money, anyway, it's for people who think of this church as their home to help it financially and to support it financially. If you're a guest here, we don't want your money. We're not interested in it. We, you know, we're just glad you're here. That's all. All right, so we've got our kids locked up in their program for another 15 or 20 minutes here, so we have some time for some questions and comments. So now's a good time. If you have a question or a comment that you'd like to throw out, just raise your hand. We'll bring you a mic, and we'll talk. Or is everyone so solidly loving that they don't have any questions? I knew it.
You? I thought it was Regis.
Oh, did he raise his hand?
No. He raised your hand.
Maybe everybody else knows this but me. But I find it interesting that when you try to love and reach out to people without God right there with you mm-hmm. in your heart and bringing you along, it doesn't work out very well mm-hmm. because bitterness, resentment, fatigue just worm their way in, or they're right there with you all the time.
Right.
And it's very important. So what I think my point is that unless you have that relationship that you are firmly grounded in and rooted in, continually going or feeding off of it is or mm-hmm.
feeding your love.
Feeding yeah. your thank you. Mm-hmm. Getting your nourishment from that, you just don't have it for someone else. Did that whole thing make sense?
It did. I'm glad you made that point. You know, it's our love relationship with Christ that allows us to love others. It's because we know that we are fully known and we are fully loved by God. That we can love other people and we don't have to be selfish. We don't have to expect them to meet our needs. We don't have to expect them to meet certain requirements that we have of them in order to feel love from them, because we have love from Christ. We don't need that anymore from them. And you're right, you're absolutely right. Without Christ's love within us and that security that we have, that he's not rejecting us, that he knows us fully and that he's not going to drop us when we start screwing up, that it allows us then to be free to love others without being selfish, because we know our needs are already being met. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. All right, over here. Keep your hand up so we can see. I don't think he saw who then. There you go, thanks.
This passage was part of a passage that helped me come to know Christ, because when I was a teenager, I was very much into like social works, mm-hmm. helping the poor, and I was awarded a humanitarian award. And when I was going up to get the award, I was very consciously aware that my relationships with individuals were really very weak. Mm. And at the time, Charles Schulz put out a Peanuts cartoon that had Linus in the first frame saying, "I love mankind." Mm-hmm. The second frame, "It's people I can't stand." And I thought that just expressed my personality really well. Mm-hmm. And I know you were saying that this passage really describes God and his love for us. Mm-hmm. But for me, I frequently, because I tend to be so arrogant, I like to look at this and evaluate how I am actually loving the real people around mm-hmm. me. And as I realized my inadequacies in meeting this definition, it was then I could turn to in humility and realize I needed to have a loving Savior. Mm-hmm. But before I did that, I was always patting myself on the back, thinking of how generous I was to these nameless masses and, you know, not really aware of how I was treating the individuals in my life.
Yeah.
So thank you for reminding me of how I came to Christ. It makes us thankful.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. I've heard somebody has said, you know, you want to learn about God, replace the word love in that passage with God. God is patient, God is kind. And which is true. You know, that's because he's describing God there. If you want to learn how you're feeling, replace your name. I am patient. I am kind. Is that true? You know, am I doing these things that I know I should be doing? And often the answer is going to be no. I mean, there's no way, especially when you get to the last few verses there where it's always, you believe all things, you endure all things. Yeah, we're not going to deal perfectly, ever. But we'll grow. We'll get better. And that's the only way we're going to do it, is through constantly looking at that and praying about it and saying, God, you know, I'm failing in this jealousy part, okay? I can't seem to get over that. God, I need you to work on me there. You know, maybe I'm doing okay with the patients, but the jealousy is terrible. Or maybe it's I'm not kind to people. And, you know, maybe I'd rather just hit them with the truth and not be very kind to them. You know, whatever you're, wherever you're struggling, praying to that and asking God to change you, and he'll honor that. Absolutely. Any other questions or comments? Somebody's, oh, right here.
Hi, Adam. Hi. Thanks for the teaching. Mm-hmm. And when you talked about growing in love, and the second part about serving, mm-hmm. and you mentioned about if you're serving others, you forget about your problems. Mm-hmm. And that's what I run into a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, Bob always tells me, you know, if you're not feeling down, or serve other. And I say, well, I'm not happy, you know. Why do I want to serve someone? You know, mm-hmm. but while I'm doing that, when I'm out there serving, God is really revealing to me, saying, well, look at what Christ has done for you. Mm-hmm. And it starts to taper off, peeling it off, you know, my ugliness or my anger. Mm-hmm. So it really does help.
Yeah.
You know, setting mine up someone else.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Thank you. Yeah, that's a great point. You know, God, yeah, if your complaint is that I'm not happy, well, then what are you looking for? You know, you got plenty of people you can serve, and then God will show you what makes you really happy.
Yeah. If I can add on to that, mm-hmm. I just wanted to thank my wife for bringing my walk with the Lord a lot stronger mm-hmm. over this past year, her and my son both, because they've just really motivated me just seeing how much they've grown mm-hmm. and how much love they've been pouring forth and out to others. It's just really motivated me to delve into the Word and to increase my prayer life and things like that. I have a long ways to go, but it yeah. sure has helped.
Yeah, there's nothing quite like being around other people who are growing to make you want to grow.
Yeah,
great point. All right, one more over here.
I was reading this morning, and I think it kind of ties in with your teaching today, Adam, about love. I was reading in 1 Peter in chapter 4, and Peter says, "The end of all things is at hand. Therefore, be of sound judgment and sober spirit for the purpose of prayer." That's the reminder for prayer today at noon. Mm-hmm. but this is the part. He says, "Above all, keep fervent in your love for one another, because love covers a multitude of sins." Mm-hmm. And, you know, in reading that, I've always thought of, okay, you know, if I'm going to love people, then I need to overlook things, and I need to be patient, and all the things that you were talking about there. Mm-hmm. But it struck me this morning when I was reading that about how Jesus' death covered all of my sins, mm-hmm. that his love covered my multitude of sins. And it made me think back on Psalm 139, where he says, "All of your days were ordained for you before you ever existed." Mm-hmm. And so it gives me comfort to think that the sins that I know, my sins in the future that are just going to shock the crap out of me, that those days were ordained. Jesus knew about them. He paid for them on the cross. Mm-hmm. And that his love covers the multitude of my sins.
Yeah.
So thanks for the teaching. It was mm-hmm. really good.
Great. That's a great point. And, you know, I think his love does cover our sins as far as God's concerned, you know. And I think the more we exercise that love for others, you know, our sins tend to fall off to the side too. You know, we tend to spend less time thinking about ourselves, and we spend less time sinning just because of that. You know, I found that the more I concentrate on others, the more I concentrate on growing in love, the less that I concentrate on doing things I shouldn't be doing. I think there's a lot that can be said about love covering sins, but I think the main one is what you said right there, is Christ's love did cover all of our sins. All right, well, I think we're running low on time, so let's take a moment or two to pray together, since we're supposed to be praying, and once we've done that, we'll have a few minutes to hang out.